Hello and welcome to the 4D Human Being podcast, where we talk about everything to do with life, leadership and love. We're here to help you gain insights and practical tools on human psychology and human behavior so that you can really get back to choice and expand your options on how you show up and how you live your life. The 4D is your fourth dimension, and that's all about your intention, your choice, taking back control so that you are happening to the world rather than the world simply happening to you. So whether it's your career, conflict, communication, or collaboration, we've got some fabulous interviews with great experts and, of course, our own 4D life hacks and chats on anything and everything that helps us be the 4D human being that we know we can be. So if you're looking to improve your impact at work, your relationships, your well-being, whether it's family relationships, friends, or how we simply make the best of our lives, this is all about getting back to choice, taking control and getting intentional, taking you from a 3D human doing to a 4D human being. Do enjoy.
So, hello and welcome to this 4D Human Being podcast. Now, this is a separate podcast from the series we've been running for some time. And this is specifically an opportunity for us to talk to leaders and leaders in different fields. And this series that I am hosting with theatre directors. Back in January of 2021, I posted an article around some of the parallels that I thought theatre directors could bring to business, some of the principles, some of the skills that they have. The second one of those is coming out in April of 2021. And to accompany that, I'm having some of these conversations. And I'm delighted to be here today with theatre director Mark Rosenblatt. Hello, Mark.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you very much for joining me, Mark. Now, before we get into what you do and how you work as a director, which I am so excited about, it's been a while since I spoke to the directors that I was working with before. It's been a good couple of years, actually. So I'm really looking forward to this very much. I wonder if you would share with the listeners just a little bit about yourself and your career and kind of where you are now. Difficult time for theatre directors, of course. So COVID may come up, but I guess, yeah, kind of what took you into theatre directing and your career so far?
Well, I've been doing it for about 20 years. I'm also a theatre director and a filmmaker, but the filmmaking is more recent. Theatre directing, yeah, I've been doing for a long time, and I started, like a lot of people, out of college, out of university with an English degree, and worked my way up, did some assistant directing, directed some early shows on the Fringe in London, yep. Set up my own theatre company.
Everyone does.
As people do. Yeah. So you're producing your own choices of work and also working to hire. And I did that for a good 10 years. And then more recently, in the last 10 years, I worked as the associate director at the National Theatre Studio for a couple of years, so I did a couple of in-house posts. That first one was at a department at the National Theatre that experiments. It's a sort of closed laboratory where they develop new projects.
Oh, great.
They are famous for developing things like War Horse and Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, but everything that is a space to try stuff out, to experiment and fail before massive investment in actual production.
Yeah.
So a lot of things don't see the light of day, and then a lot of things do, and some of those things go on to sort of conquer the world.
Well, we might talk about your specific experience there, because I guess that's maybe quite a different feel to working on a specific project, a theatre play for 4 or 5 weeks before it goes in at West Yorkshire, where, I know you've done a lot of work.
Yeah, exactly. No, I'd happily, because what I went on to do, as you just hinted at, sort of contrast with that, which is I went on to be the associate director for 4 years at Leeds Playhouse, which is like one of the big producing theatres in the country,
yeah.
i.e. it makes its own productions from scratch rather than having worked tour into them. So I was a senior manager there in a kind of corporate sense.
Yeah.
And I was also an in-house creative there, directing main house shows, but on a salaried basis rather than as a freelancer. And so I lived there for 4 years. And then subsequent to that, I've been freelancing again and working internationally and writing for film, directing for film as well.
Great.
So yeah, that's pretty much me in a nutshell. I've also done quite a lot of work outside of the rehearsing bit of being a director. I've also done a lot of work with championing, developing other emerging directors.
Fantastic.
And younger directors coming through as part of a charity that I work for. So I've got a sort of fairly holistic interest in the process of being a director.
Great. That will hopefully, you know, lend even more to the conversation that we're going to have. Thanks, Mark. That's really useful. So look, I've created these 8 principles, and look, these are broadly based on the conversations that I had with theatre directors I spoke to a couple of years ago. So Sarah and Liz and Sue Dunderdale and people. And of course, my own knowledge of dabbling a little on the fringe after I trained as a theatre director. So let's dive in with one of these. And, you know, we'll do our best to keep pulling this back from your experience, Mark, to, you know, where the parallel is with business and what business can take from the expertise of people like you. Let's start with maybe what it's like at the beginning of a process. Let's say we get a bunch of actors, the collective noun for actors. We get a group of actors together, going to put a play on. And one of the things which is always seems very important for theatre productions is creating a sense of trust very quickly. You know, you've probably got, if you're lucky, say 5 or 6 weeks, but maybe 3 or 4 weeks on a production to get a team together, get them working together closely, get them taking risks with one another, and get a production on the stage for the tickets that have been sold. Are there obvious ways in which you think, right, this is how I'm going to meld this group of people together so they become a team and can work towards this project?
Yeah, I mean, all of my answers are going to be prefaced by the inevitable that you adapt to the project,
yeah,
and that each has different demands. But yeah, I mean, I think like on a sort of maybe a less creative front, you're doing what anyone would do, which is there's a level of anxiety in the room,
yeah,
about how everyone is going to pull together to get an outcome in a short space of time. And one of the things that anyone would do, I guess, at the beginning of any process, theatre or otherwise, is to be the person that says, look, I've thought about how we're going to use our time.
Mm-hmm.
This is where we're going to be. This is where we're going to be at this point.
Yeah.
You know, this is what I am expecting. And a lot of that in terms of, this is sort of fairly nuts and bolts stuff, but for actors, I think they want to know.
Yeah.
Like, when do you need me to have learned all my lines?
Yeah.
When are we going to have our moves down?
Yeah. Yeah.
And because I'm going to need to repeat those things enough times to feel comfortable going up out in front of an audience.
Yeah.
And that is like basic. That's like before we get into conversations about the really interesting stuff.
Yeah.
I think for a cast to feel that someone is thinking about that on their behalf right at the beginning, knocking those big nervous questions on their head, because sometimes every actor will have been in a room for good or for bad where everything's been a bit last minute and a bit scary.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I've come for that at times without meaning to be or wishing to be or without being experienced enough not to be. And I think you want to let the actors feel that there's a structure, that there's just a structure around time.
Structure sets you free, right?
I guess so, yeah.
So you create the structure. You're essentially saying as the leader, look, I'll hold the process. You don't need to worry about these things. I'll take care of these things. Here are your waymarks, milestones.
Yeah.
So that you, as the actor, can get on with doing the thing that you've been employed to do and that you're going to bring your talent to.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
And, you know, in if you've got 4 weeks to rehearse a play, these can be as simple as saying, by the end of week, you know, first week, we're going to sit around the table,
yeah,
and talk about this play and read it. And in the second week, we're going to be up. I promise you, on the first day of week two, we're going to be up on our feet doing it. And by the end of the third week, we'll have done it enough that we've got a sort of repeatable shape,
yeah,
a choreography, in order that in the final fourth week in the rehearsal room, we can then start putting the whole thing together.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds so simple, but there are productions where the director's process is to sort of almost lean into a little bit more chaos.
Yeah, yeah.
In order that that might bring out more interesting results at the end of the fourth week, but it will be more terrifying for the actors.
Yeah, and you've hit on that a point there, Mark, a couple of times now. It's more prevalent in the theatre with actors, and it's not unknown in other fields as well, especially in business, which is kind of terror, anxiety, you know, just not being very worried about being the person who's got to get up on stage in 4 weeks' time and perform. And therefore, I want to know that everything is taken care of and that I am going to be taken care of. So I am not going to go on stage without being fully in charge of my lines and my moves and what's going on for my character. And of course, that's very true in business as well. People are looking to their leaders to give them, you know, to give them assurance and make sure they're not going to be, you know, going into whether it's meetings or marketing presentations or R&D processes, not knowing what the hell is going on. Aside from putting that clear process in place, what are you doing in terms of the way that you're, I guess, engaging with the actors, what you're saying to the actors, what you're outlining for them, what's happening there as well?
I mean, that's quite a big question. I would say that there are some directors who have a very, very unflinching process, a very, very deep and unflinching process that they have developed over time. That, mm-hmm. And often they're directors who are working at a very elite level where they are very, very well resourced and funded and have earned the right to ask for much longer to rehearse a play.
Yeah.
So whereas, as you said, mere mortals like me might have 4 or 5 weeks,
yeah.
Sometimes there's 8, 12 weeks to rehearse. And in that time, it's possible, and those people have earned that right often, mm-hmm. to work in a different way.
Yeah.
I work at a very high level, but I generally do work in theatres that can afford only like 4, 5, maybe 5.5, 6 weeks to rehearse. And in that time, you need a kind of variety of tools,
yeah.
to bring to bear. And some of them you'll use throughout. Sometimes on a project, you can apply them in a very rigorous way throughout the 4 weeks. Sometimes you just want to bring it in for a few days. Sometimes it's an hour where you found that particular spanner to try and loosen something up.
Yeah.
So, sorry, this is a very broad...
No, it's good. It sounds like you're... One of the other principles that I had in there was around being adaptive and empathic. And it sounds like what you're saying, Mark, is that you're constantly having to think about, one, the practicalities. I've got this amount of time. I've got this amount of money. I've got these actors in front of me. So there's that where you're adapting your process, you know, your thoughts for each play. You've got a different type of play, of course, simple terms, comedy or a farce or a tragedy or what have you, Shakespeare. But then I suppose you're also constantly in the moment thinking, what does this person need from me? That's not quite working, or this person's struggling with this, or I can push this person even further because they're doing work I'm really loving and I want to push, see how far it can go. So it sounds like you're constantly adapting and empathic to what's going on kind of in front of you in the room and in the process.
In addition, you're also matching the process with the material.
Yeah.
That's the key. I think the key thing to unlock when you approach rehearsal is, what does this material, what does this play, this project need?
Yeah.
Because you're so conscious of not wasting time.
Yeah.
That you don't want to spend 3 or 4 days or a week kind of working in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
So I feel that pressure. And I'll give an example, because maybe even if it's not something, it's a bit nerdy. But so I really enjoy working on plays about that sort of have a sense of the past of the characters. You'll see that, you know, a lot of plays like Arthur Miller or naturalistic plays where there's a deep sense of a past shared between the characters. I also really enjoy working on Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Shakespeare's not particularly interested in the past of the characters. Shakespeare is a writer who's very interested in what's happening right now.
Yeah.
Right now in the moment. And he's actually, if you tried to kind of go, okay, so what's happened in the past of this character, mm-hmm. so that we can kind of explore that, you won't get that much, or it won't be consistent, because he's not that kind of writer.
Yeah.
Whereas a sort of more naturalistic writer, someone like Chekhov or Arthur Miller, there's so much value in going, okay, what's in the past? And in order to understand the present, yeah. it's going to be on stage in front of the audience. We need, these actors need to know what these characters did last Thursday and 6 months before, and possibly even 10 years before,
yeah.
in order to make it seem credible on stage between them,
yeah.
what their relationships are.
Yeah, yeah.
That would be a key difference of approach when I'm cutting my cloth in terms of time.
Great.
And it would be a mistake, I think, to kind of try and spend a week or 2 weeks talking about what we call backstory for when you're working on A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yeah, yeah. So it's having that experience and knowledge to be able to think this is a different challenge. But as you said, what have I got in my tool bag? Right, I might apply this kind of thing to a Shakespeare process,
yeah.
but I'm not going to apply, as you say, maybe it's some improvisation or hot seating or whatever it might be, where you talk about the backstory of the characters. And look, I think that runs absolutely true into business. You know, we're dealing with one customer, we're dealing with another customer. We've got one project, we've got another project, we've got one quarter's worth of numbers to hit. It's constantly changing and adapting. And the challenge for the leader, I guess, is to, obviously in business, you're generally working with the same group of people facing lots of new challenges, is to help them to adapt to whatever the new situation is and therefore help them grow, right? So they can be more and more self-sufficient. So they don't necessarily need quite so much guidance from the leader.
Yeah.
So one of the areas that I'm always really interested in is the balance between what people think a theatre director does and what he or she actually does. And I called this a difference between leading a process but not controlling everything. And you've spoken to this already, Mark, which is that when you start a process, a Shakespeare play for 6 weeks, you don't really know what the end product is going to be. You've got some good ideas in your head. I've had design conversations and technical conversations and various things like that. You've cast the play, but really it strikes me, you're trusting the actors to join you on a journey, for want of a better metaphor, rather than, I think what a lot of people believe a theatre director does, which is say, right, you're playing Hamlet, you're going to come on here, you're going to stand there, you're going to say it like this, you're going to leave, someone else is, you know. And I wonder if you, yeah, just where's that balance for you between, you know, leading a process and being in kind of complete control of everything that happens?
I think I think it's a constant conversation you're having with yourself, because the kind of work that I most love watching in other people is where there's clearly a very playful energy on stage,
mm-hmm.
where something has been released between the performers that isn't about, that has to have come from a collaboration between the director and the actors. And when I say collaboration, I mean like doing structured but sort of often could be quite left field exercises, improvisations and games,
yeah,
that release an energy and a sense of connection between the performers which is underlying the basic stuff about, you know, learning lines and fulfilling moves. It's the manner in which it's occurring, not the fact that it is occurring. So trying to find a playfulness, yeah, it's tricky. And actually, even as I say that, I'm also aware that by giving actors what we might call like a track or a choreography,
yeah, yeah,
that you're working out together, once that choreography is learned, that in itself, which can sound quite dry when I describe it like that, but that in itself, when filled and owned by a performer, can be a basis for incredible playfulness.
Right, right.
So it's like you're acknowledging that playfulness in and of itself can create some lovely energy on stage, something very watchable, something very, you know, madcap or mm-hmm. visceral.
Yeah.
Because you're not thinking in an outcome-orientated way. You're not thinking with a sort of front load, we've got to achieve this scene and then do the next.
It's got to look like this, yeah.
Yeah, it's something spontaneous has occurred. But at the same time, you have to, and this is the endless frustration and brilliance of theatre, is it has to really be repeatable.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So you're making repeatable spontaneity.
Yes, right.
That is, for me, the ultimate paradox of making live performance.
Yeah. And this is interesting, isn't it? Because this is where it must be tempting for directors. And of course, you're younger than me, Mark, but I think our contemporaries, when, I mean, there is theatre directing training right now. There didn't used to be. Even 15, 20 years ago, there was no theatre director training.
Right.
It generally came from people who no longer wanted to act, or maybe they trained as actors but preferred directing. And I think the generations before us would have been, this is how you do it. I expect you to come on and do it like this. I need it to be more like this. Walk over there. And it's, you can see why it was tempting, right? Because then you are in control of what it's going to look like. But of course, as you say, when you go to that extreme, you lose so much of the wonderful spontaneity, and especially when it's got to be repeatable. And you don't want to be 3, 4 weeks, months even into a run, and it starts to feel incredibly dead on stage because people just learnt the moves and learnt the lines.
Yeah.
It's got to, as you said, it's got to have a life and a spontaneity that sustains itself through.
It's got to be fuel in the tank.
Yeah, and I think it's the same. It's very much the same for business. One of the things that managers and leaders in business will say to me and the rest of my colleagues, you know, a lot around team performance is my team, I need to find a way to get my team to take ownership and do things for themselves rather than asking me all the time for the answers, right? And I've directed a bit of amateur theatre in my time as well. And one of the big differences with amateur theatre is really, really want to be told how to do it early on. Tell me how to do it, how to say it, where to be. And me having to push back, I'm not telling you how to say it or how to do it. It's, we'll work together and we'll find some options, and then, you know, we'll explore those. And that is very often what business leaders want from their teams, is come to me with options. We can talk about them. You can try things if they fail, but you're trying them in the, you know, because you think it's the right thing. That's okay. And I think it's very similar. I think it's very similar to what directors are trying to do in that balance that you talk about there, Mark.
I think a lot of it also comes down to confidence. Mm-hmm. You know, you're talking about a spectrum of confidence from amateur to professional.
Yeah.
And I mean, everyone's got confidence in different ways.
Yeah.
But what you describe, you know, tell me where to go, where to be, how to say it, how to do it, that is partly to do with a lack of, well, lots of things, but a sort of, on some level, a lack of confidence.
Yeah. Yeah.
And,
if I get it right, I can polish it and then I'll be fine, isn't it?
Yeah. And, but also getting it right is what you say. Is right. Mm-hmm. I'll feel that when there's a confidence in your collab, in the people you're working with, that is where, what I'm trying to say is where I have the confidence to let you fly.
Yeah.
To let you discover and own and play, where I'm confident enough to not feel that I have to micro manage.
Yeah.
Re-step the way for you. That's also really interesting. I mean, I know directors that who are really confident. Mm. You can will say to a couple of actors, in, you know, in a big scene, look, just go away and make something.
Right. Okay. Okay.
Go away and make something. Bring it back. I'll have a look.
Right.
And then he'll tweak it a bit, but he's not on top of them. He's because he trusts himself.
Yes.
He trusts the structure he's built around them.
Yeah.
And he trusts them.
Yeah.
To make something.
Because he's hired good people.
Yeah.
And yeah. He's saying, you bring it back to me and I'll edit from what I see in front of me. I don't need to be in control of all of it to know that it'll be good because I've hired good people and I'm creating a process. That's great.
Yeah.
I think that's really interesting. I think that's really easy. And as I say, I think it's very prevalent in business. Very prevalent is that challenge of how do I free my team enough so they feel they can go and do and play and explore and try without everything having to come back through me. And sometimes it's more difficult in business. You know, you maybe those individuals are spending resources. There's a reputation of a company, you know, in real time being put on the line for whatever reason. But getting that balance is difficult.
I was going to say, it's worth qualifying that example I gave of that director who does that.
Mm.
I think he is a director who he's often quite high, a very conceptual director.
Okay.
So he often creates very high concept productions with a kind of narrative superstructure or an aesthetic superstructure.
Just to unpack that a little bit for me.
Well, yeah,
so
sure.
It's got a clear sort of visual thing. So
yeah,
saw a production of Midsummer Night's Dream that was all in mud, right? Everyone had to wade through mud.
Yeah.
That's Joe Hill Gibbons' production. Yeah. I loved it, right? And there was another one he did where everyone had to wade through Measure for Measure, everyone had to wade through plastic dolls, which said something about the prevalence of sex in the society, right?
Yeah.
Is that the kind of thing that you...
Yeah, that kind of thing. So very, very exactly that kind of thing. And I think when you create that, and then you say to actors, right, now in this moment in the show, you've got this bit of mud, or those, you know, you've got this bit of the, this bit of the world I created. I want you to now just go away and make something. That
right. Okay.
I think there's probably, that's again, an example of structure sets you free, because
yeah.
the gesture I'm making is to say, look, go and just own this moment. And yeah. I want it to be, you know, yours, but it's going to fit inside the bigger picture.
Perfect. Perfect. Hi, this is Matt from 4D Human Being. We hope you're enjoying this podcast. If you haven't done so already, please do subscribe. And if you'd like to learn more about our work, please visit our website, 4dhumanbeing.com, where you can find blogs, videos, and sign up to our monthly newsletter. But for now, let's head back to the show. Now, that brings me to another point, which is about creating a clear vision.
Yeah.
As well as a process. And this isn't always necessarily easy, and it will depend, I'm sure, on the play. But is that something that you would look to do at the beginning as well, to say, you know, we're setting this play here in this time, here is the set and the design, here is the playground. And does that also help for the actors? So yes, they've got their process in terms of when things are going to happen, but they also understand the limits within which they can play in terms of the geography of the set, the time period, etc. Is that something you're very keen to set out quite early?
Without question, yeah.
Right.
I've never worked in any other way. I've never, obviously we've made discoveries and filled in gaps, but it, you know, in the 4 weeks, 5 weeks of rehearsal, but I've never not worked my ass off with my creative, the design team ahead of rehearsals. And a lot of the conversations we're having now, everything we're saying, all these choices are very predicated on the means of production. Mm-hmm. Like, it is worth saying, like you referenced earlier, a time before now where directors sort of almost marshal their actors quickly through a bunch of pre-made choices.
Yeah.
But that was happening because of the means of production. The means of production were high turnover, these repertory theatres that had high turnover, working often. We've been talking about rehearsing for 4 or 5 weeks. These guys were returning around full shows in a week.
Yeah.
So there was no time. They came in with their lines learned. They made quick character choices, and they delivered a show to an audience within a week or 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And so there was no time for standing around and exploring and experimenting and having long and speculative conversations where something interesting may come out of it or may not.
Yeah,
it was results. We've extended that process now because we're trying to have a more rich exploration of a play before we put it in front of an audience. The reason I said that was because, you know, when you're making, as I have spent, say, 4 years making productions at Leeds Playhouse, our process was very much dictated by the bigger technical picture, which is that we had a huge design workshop.
Yeah.
And they decided that because of their schedule, that they needed the design delivered 2 months before we started rehearsals.
Right. Okay.
So these designs cost money, and they need costing, and they need to come in on budget and all that stuff. So all of those choices are happening before actors have turned up.
Yeah.
So what you are doing is turning up with something that is, it's a very hard balance again to strike, which is something you've got to create a physical production, physical set that can tell the story of the play 2 months before you've had a chance to put any of the actors who are your key storytelling elements on it. And so you, again, like you keep saying, I think what's fundamentally happening there is you're trying to create a design that has enough space for the performers to play in, but answers the questions that they themselves can't answer in terms of telling story.
Yes, okay.
You know, you've got to have worked out where that door is and how far away it is from that other thing so that you can get the timing of that entrance right, because they're not going to rebuild the set.
Yeah.
You've got to work that some of those logistical things out, but you also want enough playful space for the actors to enjoy being on that stage.
Well, and that's the thing about design, isn't it? And I remember, you know, that showing, the model box showing which is quite a thing, whether you do it on the first day or, you know, a little while into the rehearsal period. But that opportunity for the actors to see the model of what the set will look like, I remember actors generally love it. You know, it's an exciting moment for them.
Yeah.
And it just brings me back to that point around setting a vision, right? Yeah. And I think the leader in business as well as in theatre, what she is trying to do, she or he is trying to do all the time is, I want to create a vision for you that the team who are working can be motivated by and can say, gosh, you know, if that's where we're going. And that, you know, I think that has a big element of trust, right?
Yeah.
My God, if that's where we're going and I believe in you to get us there because you're telling us about the process that you're creating, then it's easier for me to trust in this and everything around me, trust in everything around it.
Totally, yeah. And especially some of the shows I've directed that are a bit more epic.
Yeah.
I've had to really, really work hard to come in on that first day or second day and storyboard the whole show.
Right.
Even with this disclaimer, things may change.
Yeah.
We may come up with a better solution than this, but in this scene, this is how it's going to look. And that's how we're going to tell this story. And I say epic, I'm sort of mainly thinking of Shakespeare's where it can be very driven by interpretation. So the actors are going, well, we're going to do Richard III. Where are we going to set it? Is it, how are we going to do, if it's set contemporary, how are we going to do medieval battle scenes?
What's
the contemporary equivalent of those? What have you come up with? Is this very small company going to pretend to be two big armies without looking, you know, embarrassing?
Yeah.
And so coming up with playful and credible and exciting solutions on that first day can set a lot of anxiety a bit more at ease.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. So there's an amount that you've got already sorted because, as you say, for practical reasons as well as others, you need to. And then there's an amount which is fluid and is going to depend on what happens in the room. And that's, of course, the nature of the world. I'd love to talk to you a little bit about the way that you talk to actors and particularly how you kind of stimulate their creativity. Because as we've said, you're not saying to them, right, come on, stand there, say it like this. And you've talked about another director who sort of said, just go off and create something, come back and let's see what happens. Just talk to me a little bit about, you know, things like how you ask questions, I guess. I called it in one of my pieces around framing constraints. So, you know, you might say to an actor, you know, you've only got an amount of time to do this scene or to deliver this speech, or, you know, this has happened to you, or that's happened, or someone's waiting, or it's raining, or how do you go about doing that?
I mean, certainly, like, with the kinds of plays that are naturalistic and about people like us with pasts,
I think
it is really important to agree on what did happen to those people as far as is possible to say.
Yeah, yeah.
So to improvise the past and choose to make sure that actors who are playing, say, a married couple really, really do understand what happened and to let them experience that through improvisation.
Yeah.
And discover it through certain kinds of improvisation is a good way of shutting down all the other possibilities.
Okay.
So that there is clarity between them.
And improvisation is an interesting one because I think when people who don't know anything about theatre hear the word improvisation, they'll think, whose line is it anyway? They'll think, you know, kind of free for all. But I think what you're talking about, correct me if I'm wrong, Mark, is quite a specific process where you're saying, right, as you said, married couple in a Arthur Miller play, right, you're going to now improvise, you know, the day you met, for example, or the evening after you've given birth to your first child or whatever it might be. So you're setting them quite a specific field, I'm guessing, to run that improvisation. Maybe you're telling them what they want from each other. How might that work?
Well, yeah, exactly. As you say, if you just ask people to say, oh, look, meet in a park and meet each other, what will likely happen is very undisciplined babbling. Talking and not quite talking as human beings would talk often.
Yeah.
So it is important to whatever you're going to put in place has got to be a way about limiting choices in order to get the most out of what is said and to force what is said to be a kind of fertile and interesting conversation.
Yeah.
So you could, as you said, you know, you can put lots of parameters in place, like the weather, or it's, you know, it rained that day,
yeah,
and you rushed for cover, and even within that, you can find little micro details that could force that conversation, because maybe the thing that you're trying to work out is, how did these couple of real opposites meet in the first place? They're from different worlds. One is an extrovert, one's an introvert. You're trying to unlock the very thing that might have connected them. So part of the interest for me in improvisation is to have a question to ask, to then to maybe that is your question. How the hell do these two people get together? Let's reconstruct something that maybe enables us to follow that curiosity through to maybe find an answer.
Right.
And that is interesting. So it's not just like about creating a sort of a history just for the sake of creating one.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
Trying to inform the like, just be curious.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier on as well about physical things, I think. And we were talking before we came onto the on air, for want of a better word, about actioning. So about some quite specific theatre processes for working with actors, all of which, it seems to me, are trying to, as you say, create more richness.
Yeah.
Create more richness in the eventual play, product, character relationships that the audience will see.
Yeah.
And I guess as you become more experienced as a leader, you're finding, you said earlier on about being adaptive, you're finding different ways of doing it for different people, and you're trying something and maybe it doesn't work, and trying something else. As I guess you're editing a lot from what's happening in the room, right? And experimenting a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know if you want me to talk about actioning.
Yeah, go on. Give me a potted actioning.
Some actors find actioning really boring.
Right.
It's a way of creating a kind of a score for the actor that can sit above, it almost annotates every bit of dialogue. And it gives each bit of dialogue, each thing that each sort of unit or each phrase that the actor has to say, an intention. Okay. And that intention is to they've got with those words. So let's say the phrase is, do you want to walk into the garden with me? And that might have some subtext. What does he mean? Does he mean, I'm going to kill you in the garden? Is he trying to seduce the person into coming into the garden? Or does he just want to have a cup of tea? Or does he want to get that person out of the room because something else needs to happen in the room that he doesn't want them to see? Mm-hmm. And by pinning down what they're trying to do with the phrase, do you want to come into the garden with me? Actioning comes in because you can... You create a little score of like intention underneath it that the actor can repeat, so that the purpose, the little purpose of that phrase is fixed. And when you string all of those little annotations together, you can get something quite interesting and quite in the moment and quite rich and almost a bit like at its best how people speak, because people are constantly shifting what they mean and what they're trying to say and what they're trying to do to other people as they speak. But it takes a long time to do. Because you're going, oh, what is the intention of that line? And how? What is the best sort of action that I've got to sort of underscore that line? And actors can kind of go a bit mad doing it.
Yeah.
So it's, some people do it for a whole production.
Yeah.
Like every line will be actioned. And sometimes that's a drain. And sometimes you have to take a view on it and go, actually, hang on. We're not going to do the whole play like this, but there is a tricky scene and we're just going to apply it here. Because everyone's talking in quite a coded way. Or this is quite a bland scene. We feel that the writing is quite bland here. Let's give it some specificity.
Okay, okay.
So you're applying, like I said at the beginning, one of your tools. And I've probably not explained it clearly enough for the person listening to understand what is actually happening.
Well, no, it's great, Mark. It's great. And, well, our listeners who know 4D well will know intentions, because it's at the center of our model, because our model has been fed into from acting. So the idea about being very intentional about what I am trying to do to my audience, or what one actor is trying to do to another actor, is right at the center of the work that we do.
Like, in the end, what we're trying to do on stage, particularly with say like the main character's story, is work out, you know, what do they want? What does a person want? Full stop.
Yeah.
Like, give it a concrete example. Macbeth wants to be king. Mm-hmm. And what is going to stop him getting there? are the obstacles in his way. And so our job, however we arrive at it, is to tell that story has got to be to make the idea of intention to go. The idea of intention is a big arc.
Yeah.
Of like, I want that big thing. But on the way, it's going to break down into all sorts of little mini intentions.
Yeah.
And that's what we're trying to do, is like the micro and the macro at the same time. The micro's got to correspond to the macro. So the tiny little units of work we're doing are leading somewhere big. And when you stitch it together and it feels like you've released a kind of energy.
Yeah.
It's working. It takes a long time to get there because it's really tiny stitches that you're stitching together. But once you run the whole thing together at the end of those 4 or 5 weeks and you've made some of the right decisions, you can feel the flow of it.
Yeah. It's great, Mark. It's great. I think so much of what you've talked about through this, and I'm conscious of time, I do want to ask you one more question. So much of what you've talked about is about not going straight to the result, right? It is about creating richness through a process, through whatever tools you use, whatever ways in which you're talking to your cast and inspiring them and making them feel safe. It's all about creating a rich experience, a sustainable experience. And one of the other areas, and I was talking earlier on about business leaders talking about their teams, you know, not feeling empowered enough to go and do. The other problem is, you know, people just doing the same thing they've done before, many, many times before. And really what leaders want from their teams often is creativity, a new idea, new ways of solving problems for customers, whether they're internal customers or external customers. Because going straight to, you know, the result, what we did last time, is rarely the most creative solution. And you know, in business, just like in theatre, resources are always limited. There's never enough people. There's never enough money. So how can we find creative solutions is always the problem, leaders. And I think what you're highlighting is that having a very strong process and a great attention to detail of a process can give you that far more than, look, just go and do it like this, right? And it's much more enjoyable for the team. Right.
Yeah.
I guess when you're starting a production of Macbeth, the chances of the perfect Macbeth, the whole play being in your head when you begin, the chance of that being better than the collective endeavor of your entire cast is minuscule, right? So you're much better off finding ways, as you clearly do, Mark, of bringing out the best of your team, right? Rather than thinking you've got to tell them how to do everything.
Yeah. And the excitement then is that when you start, you've committed to like really exploring it together.
Yeah.
You then watch something happen on stage that makes you realize you didn't, something you've missed or didn't realize. And then you go back and say, oh, I've just, hang on. I can see something. I've missed something completely.
Yeah.
And we need to just change that dynamic between that character and that character, because the scene isn't making sense without it. But you've only been able to do that by creating a sort of collective endeavor. You know, you can only be able to create, you've got to be able to push forward without knowing everything in order to find out the things you didn't even know you didn't know.
Yeah. And you need them to trust you to do that, right?
Yeah.
Because if they don't trust you, they want you to signpost absolutely everything.
Yeah.
Because that, you know, they're putting their, well, careers on there in your hands.
Yeah.
And of course, if you said earlier on, no one wants to go on stage looking foolish. That's nothing worse.
Yeah.
As we've all had that experience.
No, I was going to say, like, in full circle, and maybe this is what you were going to talk about, but we talked at the beginning about the National Theatre Studio where I used to work, which is it's a research and development laboratory.
Right.
And we've also talked about the means of production in theatre and the kind of different models that have, you know, in terms of just like having 2 weeks to rehearse, then having in more recent decades 4 or 5 weeks to rehearse, and then, you know, and just having more time and space to explore. Well, the National Theatre Studio is an example of a space that has been created to even short circuit the limitations of that 4 or 5 weeks. So before the design has been delivered, before you've even necessarily brought your whole creative team together, which all happens months before rehearsals, even before that, you're talking about being in a room in this kind of studio environment where you can really try the mad stuff out.
Right. Like, okay.
Spend a week really like going to the big weird idea that you've had conceptually and seeing if that, so you're separating that from the main making process, the main time.
Yeah.
And you're giving yourself a chance to really like stretch and try something that may fall flat on its face, out of which you may discover one little aspect of design idea or something that really you take into the process with you. But it takes the risk away.
Well, it's safe, isn't it?
Yeah.
You're saying to the actors, this in this format is never going to be seen by an audience. You know, it's months away. So you don't need to worry about any of that. We're just here to play. I think there's loads of parallels with that in business.
Yeah, I'm sure there are.
I think business people often feel they don't have the opportunity to do those kinds of things. One of the pieces we will often do with a group is a creative constraint exercise where you'll just say to people, right, imagine you've got to do your job, but only with half the time. Or you've got to still hit the same number with half the customers. How are you going to go about doing it? And you give them 20 minutes, 30 minutes to think about these things, and they come up with crazy ideas. You know, everything from cloning oneself to robbing back, you know, whatever it is, you go to crazy places, you will always end up with one or two ideas that you say, why don't we just do that already? Why don't we just do that right now? And of course, COVID has been the classic creative constraint exercise for millions of businesses.
And I also think I remember it when I was at Leeds Playhouse, you know, there are offices as well as theatres there, and there are teams of people as an accounts department. And I remember there was often conversations at times we had to, you know, as lots of businesses do, have to reorganize the office space to, you know, have one department come into a existing department's open plan and try and work out what the best workflow was for that space. And I remember we'd always try and work these things out in, we're so rushed for time that we, you know, would often sort of sit around and try and work it out in front of everyone, or there was always a process of working on it that always felt wrong.
Right.
And I would always suggest, we never did it, that we try and prototype the room in one of our rehearsal rooms and just take half a day and just almost do a mock-up of the office. Imagine from different people's points of view.
Yeah.
It was just, I only say that as a way of saying that we, in lots of business structures, lots of corporate structures, including theatres, the point in time at which we start trying to problem solve is often too far down the track.
And
the decisions get rushed.
Yeah.
And to have space to prototype something, if you can do it, to prototype in a creative way, it takes more time at the beginning of the process, but it really sort of shortcuts you to more successful choices.
Yeah.
And it's having the imaginative space to work out what that prototyping might look like. Is it setting up that open plan in a kind of dummy run in another room and seeing what and thinking about different colleagues' points of view and who needs to be listening, who needs to be near that desk to overhear those conversations in order to take information onto the next step of the process. But like, how do you work that stuff out?
Yeah. No, and you're right. And when resources are tight, both space and time and money, it's very tempting to go straight to obvious, what we've done before, straight to results.
Yeah, well, just come on, let's just get on with it. Let's get on with it and do it.
And
we'll find out.
And for the leader to pick up all the responsibility for making that happen, as opposed to pushing some of that out. Mark, I want to ask you one more question.
Yeah.
Because we talked a lot about working with actors and process. How conscious are you of the way that you talk to the actors? Because it's something that I'm, you know, very mindful of. I was when I was directing and am with talking to business people about how they talk to their teams, you know, to encourage people to take risks and try things and not feel they're going to be, you know, hauled over the coals for making a mistake. Has it just become very natural to you now? How conscious are you about how you talk to the actors, the sort of language that you use?
I think I'm a bit of a split personality.
Okay.
I would say one of my weaknesses is I've had to work hard to get better at it over the years, is I don't have a great poker face.
Okay.
It's not a good look, but I don't intend to, but I sometimes wear my heart on my sleeve so much that actors can see when something isn't working. Mm. And that is not to be recommended. In this part, answer to your question, when we've spent a lot of time building something and then it doesn't feel as if it's working, and I feel the pressure of time to sort of get results, that can make me get quite tense and frustrated with myself when I'm watching something that doesn't quite, for some reason, isn't quite working. And what I should be doing is remaining completely, appearing to be calm and supportive of what is happening in the room, and putting those thoughts down on notes in the confidence that we can sort them out.
Yes.
Rather than doing what I sometimes do, which is express, you can see it in my body that I'm frustrated that I can't, that it's not, something's not quite right.
Yeah.
I will be honest and say that I'm not like, I wish I had a kind of beatific, peaceful, you know, repose when I'm watching stuff. And I'm very aware that I've tried to get better at it over time.
Yeah.
And in actually just in posture as well, just trying to sit up in the room and lean into what they're doing and almost sort of gently brace myself for things not going right, so that I'm not physically crashing or kind of taking, expressing frustration or you know, I'm really a football manager who is not allowed to shout from the sidelines. That's my
Jurgen Klopp of theatre directors.
Yeah, where you can't talk. It's not that. It's not that kind of coaching. But then on the other side, I would say that I'm quite a fun person in the room. I'm quite. I like to be aware that whilst we're doing is important, it's also a bit daft.
Right. Okay.
And it is make believe. And I think I'm. It's a hard balance to strike because you've got to be tough in the right way, as in you've got to be disciplined with your time. You've got to be constantly aware that the tea break's coming. You're supposed to be at this point and you're an hour behind. Mm-hmm. You've got all sorts of other things crashing on the schedule, and yet you've got to stay present with the person you're working with to keep them moving forward.
Yeah.
And, you know, showing your vulnerability emotionally so that you're not just a kind of in a sort of like a position of instruction. You're someone who's sharing what they feel and how they connect with the material. I will often share how I connect it with the material through experiences in my own life in order to create a space where the actor can do the same.
Yeah.
And we often talk about that in rehearsals. I think those kinds of conversations are probably harder to have in a corporate environment where you're opening yourself up to corporate codes of behavior that are different in theatre, where there's an expectation of kind of sharing emotional stuff.
Yeah, I think that's true. You're right. I mean, obviously theatre is a space where one expects the main people who are taking part, particularly the main storytellers, to be emotionally available and vulnerable. I would say I think it's changing quite a lot. I think there is a recognition that a degree of opening up, a degree of vulnerability, that doesn't necessarily mean opening up about one's personal life. It might be about the professional circumstances. Is, you know, I think it's recognized it's a key way of creating trust, right? You know, and particularly if I admit my mistakes, you know, and you'll have had the experience, I'm sure, of saying, sorry, that was a rubbish note. Forget that, you know, scrub that. We'll go back to where we were before. And I think the same is true for leaders in business. The ability to say, look, you know, we set out on this month, but actually I think I made a couple of wrong calls. So we're going to rethink and we're going to do this. I think what that says to people is you can make mistakes. It is okay. It is okay to admit them. So you don't double down on the mistakes, and it is okay to come and ask for help. And I think that's very powerful. And the other thing is very powerful is what you talked about a second ago, Mark, is about having fun, right?
Yeah.
Creativity. So much. It's very helpful if you can be having some fun when we're in a creative space.
Yeah. And you know, when you walk into the room every morning, you want to feel this is both a place where we're going to make progress today, but people are not sort of quietly, seriously waiting to start.
Yeah.
You know, there's conversation, you know, there is a bubbling and playful atmosphere in the room.
Yeah. And that comes from the leader, right? A lot of the time you are setting, you know, you just talked about the conscious effort that you have made around your physicality in the room. Because I think one of the challenges that business people feel, and I think theatre directors as well, particularly when they go from actor to director, is everyone is looking at me.
Mm.
You know, you are getting the eyeballs of everyone way more than you used to when you were you know, just another person around the boardroom table, or, you know, another actor in the room. When you're the director or when you're the leader, the eyeballs are on you and you've got to be aware of it, you know, and it's tough, but that is every word that comes out of your mouth and everything that you're doing with your face is having an impact on those people around you. It goes with the territory, I think.
Yeah.
Mark, thank you so much. I've taken up far too much of your time, but that has absolutely flown by. And there was so many wonderful insights into your work and the work of a theatre director. So thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us.
Great pleasure.
And look forward to speaking to you again soon.
All right, brilliant. Nice to chat.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the 4D Human Being Podcast. We hope you enjoyed the show, and if you did, please do tell your friends and colleagues. For more information on our programs, our on-demand courses, and to sign up to our monthly newsletter, do check us out at 4dhumanbeing.com. Until the next time.